CRIB English Radio presents Viewpoint.
Viewpoint.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars from CRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of CRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with the thoughts and words of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts for today's episode. Brother Ali Alavian, salam alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, salam alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So many people all across the world were listening to the words and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and may not know him, may understood that he is only a political leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, but they don't know that many of the speeches of the leader were concerned with the akhlaqi parts, and he is in fact a teacher of akhlaq and ethics too. For dear listeners, I must say that Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has regular teaching sessions regarding the fiqh, the akhlaq, and we can say the other specific and specialized fields of study regarding Islamic studies. And on different occasions, he has invited his audience, listeners, politicians, and the youth in order to follow the, we can say, Islamic akhlaq and the rulings and Islamic rulings. And he elaborated on them very beautifully. You can refer to Khamenei.ir or leader.ir in order to have the English translation and all the languages of his outstanding speeches regarding Islamic akhlaq. So we have been concerned with the topic self-recognition and self-knowing in the speeches of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In a previous discussion, Sayyid Mohsen and Brother Ali Alavian tried to elaborate on some of the introductory remarks or preparations in order to reach a kind of self-recognition. I've said this self-recognition means knowing your spirituality, finding a kind of spiritual evolution and perfection, and then reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Some of our dear listeners might be interested in the practical guidelines, Sayyid Mohsen. Also, the leader of Iran has elaborated some steps in order to reach a kind of a perfect self-recognition. What are they, and what is the need for practical guidelines in the lives of the Muslims today?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 35, verse 15, has clearly said, Ya ayyuhan nas antumul fuqara'u ila Allah, wallahu huwal ghaniyul hamid. Allah has said that you all mankind, all of you are poor in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and only it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who is self-sufficient. In the next verse, he says like, إِنْ يَشَأْ يُذْهِبْكُمْ وَيَأْتِي بِخَلْقٍ جَدِيدٍ. If he wills, he can remove you and bring instead a new creation.
That's right.
In the speeches of the Supreme Leader, Hazrat Ayatollah Khamenei, we can see the same, he's referring to the same verses basically. He says, always remember that we are nothing and everything is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In the life of all the mystics, if you look, the big mystics that have passed in the history, their books and their speeches, if you look at that,
yes,
they all had this common thing in them, that they used to say like, we are nothing, it is only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
They used to refer everything back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And they were not talking about themselves, like there was nothing as I.
Yes.
It was all Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
It is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Even in the Persian, even in the Persian poetry,
yeah,
we can find when you read out Maulana Rumi,
mm-hmm,
Maulana known as Rumi in the West, and Hafez, Sana'i, Sahib, and the other, we can say, who were great mystics, you know, at their times, you cannot find this mania,
yes,
selfhood,
mania,
or self-centricism in themselves. All the things, you know, we're talking about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God the Creator. Okay.
It's all about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
The point is that in the Quran, where chapter 35, verse 15, Allah is saying, Ya ayyun nas antumul fuqara'u ila Allah, it means that He is reminding us, He is basically alarming us, that maybe because I have created you, you become, for example, a president, a minister, a teacher, maybe a politician, or you will have a status, like a material status in this world. Don't think, or maybe you become a rich person, don't think that you become a master. You all are poor. I have given you everything. If practically we want to go towards the self-knowledge and self-building, obviously the very first step is that we should see Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in all aspects of life.
That's right.
If we are able to do this, then we are having a just life. Mm-hmm. Obviously,
and by seeing means considering.
Considering, yes. Yeah. By seeing means, obviously, we have a story from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam as well. You just remind me of that story that a person came to Imam and he said, do you worship Allah, the God who you have seen? He said, yes, I worship. I don't worship anyone who I haven't seen.
Okay.
And he said, did you saw with these eyes, these mortal eyes that you have? He said, woe on you that he cannot be seen with this, but you need to feel him, obviously, with the basira.
Very good.
The insight.
Yeah.
You need to
know about knowing self.
Yes. Again, knowing
self. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
again, knowing self that if I have these characteristics, then the one who has created me,
that's right,
how almighty he is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we refer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he is Aziz, almighty.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, he is the Khaliq and Qadir and all those characteristics that we obviously refer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with those names. So basically, we need to see obviously all these scholars, especially we do not have this recognition of supreme leader as being a mystic.
Oh,
we just know him as a leader.
As Arif.
As we don't know him that he is also an Arif.
Yes.
Because there is a very famous also sentence or a speech from Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Amli.
Yes.
That look at the lips of the, pay attention towards the sayings of the leader, supreme leader, because he has attention towards the imam of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever he says, especially in this regard, in the regards of being Irfan or mysticism, or being a scholar, obviously he has the lectures on the jurisprudence, he has lectures on the ethics, he has lectures on the history as well, he has political lectures as well. And on top of that, he is the supreme leader as well.
Yes.
So sometimes we ignore the main aspect of these people, why they became leader and why they are at the say at this position.
That's right.
We can also see this in the life of Imam Khomeini as well.
Yeah,
if I refer to Imam Khomeini, how he was referring towards being presence in the we are in the presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, fear Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to the officials, like the government officials, to the people, to different obviously
This was what attracted so many foreigners and Westerners. You know, when the media men and reporters came to him and find this tranquility, he said, this man is very different from the other politicians of the world, you know, that we have, we can't say, reported such tranquility and calmness comes from inside.
I hope that we might can have a special program on their lifestyle. Especially the Supreme Leader and Imam Khomeini.
That's right. Inshallah.
Because these, if we can know about their personal life, how they're living now, maybe our audience can get closer to what they are saying.
That's all right.
Because what they say, practically they are doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And between their saying and practical, there is no difference.
That's right.
And because they're practically living and Allah has given them these, this honor that they have, وَلِلَّهِ الْعِزَّةِ وَالْمُؤْمِنِينَ وَلِلْرَسُولِ. So this respect is given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because they are basically submissive to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right. Okay. Thank you, Sayyid Mohsen. And Brother Ali, how much do you think reading the life accounts of the previous scholars and mystics, and by mystics in quotation, we have to say that this mysticism we are talking about is very much different from the Hindu one, or the Western one. This mysticism and Irfan.
It's also different from tasawwuf.
Yeah, it is from Sufism. Yeah. This mysticism is, in fact, inside Iran, we can say, inside Islam and the Islamic rulings and based on Islamic rulings. So how much do you think reading out? So what's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his purified progeny. Yes, you are right, brother. Actually, studying biographies of the scholars and those who stepped in the actually way of perfection, those who started, those wayfarers that actually
wayfaring is a nice term you used, brother.
Those wayfarers that started in the way of perfection, I think it's a good role model for the human beings.
Yes.
But before that, we need to strengthen our faith and iman and beliefs through gaining some information, increasing the information that we need to bring us a sort of awareness and awakening. And these awakening can actually reach us through some sources. One of these sources is Al-Quran. Actually, reciting Quran, it is famous even by the understanding of a hadith and narrations. It says that focusing on Quran, recitation of the Holy Quran, pondering on the verses and their translations and their interpretation to the level that we can understand them, is a good way to revive the dead souls and the dead selves. So it is a good primary step for actually to enter this way. It is famous that actually Quran revives the qulub, the hearts. So in case there is a problem with us and we have been lagging behind because of, I don't know, so many factors that we have,
yes,
we did not notice, we can actually compensate it by focusing and reciting the Holy Quran and pondering on the verses of God.
Okay.
And it rapidly compensates for those who have actually who stopped or who yet did not find the chance to
enter.
It's
a kind of healing.
The
right.
Healing is inside it.
Yes.
So the healing is not actually just physical healing.
Yeah.
Spiritual healing also,
yes, brother,
is inside the Quran.
That.
When Quran says that the shifa, the healing, as you said, is in it, is
mm-hmm.
not necessarily material
yeah.
healing,
yeah.
rather spiritual as well.
The spiritual
so
shortcomings can be healed too.
Reciting Quran and having a good communication with Quran actually is the key way for those who want to enter in this phase.
Okay.
But studying the biography and life account of early scholars of akhlaq and moralities is another way that actually has been practiced by many scholars, and it is one of the also important ways that we can take lots of knowledge about the self, and we see that how human beings, ordinary human beings,
mm-hmm.
have stepped in this way, and they reach to some good conclusions.
That's
and
right.
This is the famous, quote by Ayatollah Bajad, the late Ayatollah Bajad, when he was asked that, "What did you do that you have become like this?" First, he replies that, "I did not become anything. I'm nothing."
Mm-hmm.
And so this is out of his humbleness that he answers like this. But when he was insistingly asked that, what did you do that you reached to this level of, for example, knowledge and ma'rifah,
mm-hmm.
he replied at the beginning that I started to start my Islamic studies. I focused on studying tarajim, or the books of biography of the scholars.
That's right.
And it is being said that why he answered in such a way, because human beings, when they study about the Ahlul Bayt and the infallibles, they might find a sort of hindrance between themselves and the Ahlul Bayt. They say they are infallible, I cannot be like an infallible
mm-hmm.
person. But when I'm studying about a person who is a scholar of akhlaq and morality, this is something that might come to the mind of the
right.
ordinary people like
very,
me.
Very important.
So they can make a good actually communication between themselves and those scholars of akhlaq who were not infallible.
Mm-hmm.
And they started a way, and it reached to a conclusion. And it led to a conclusion,
that's
and
right.
it was a sort of purification of the self. So they have. We clearly can see from these people, even in our society, wherever
right.
we are. There are some people that focus on their own selves, and they actually brought up their own self, and at the same time, they actually have a control of their body as
that's
well.
Right.
And also, they are good role models in our today's life, and we can take lots of lessons from that.
Very good, brother. For sure, reading out the life accounts of the previous scholars and the, we can say, mystics, Islamic Muslim mystics, is very important. Okay, thank you much. Said Mohsen Naqvi, inshallah, Allah help us on this path of recognizing ourselves in a true manner. And do not forget that everything pass is through the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Having reading the Holy Quran and respecting for our parents, and also having a good ustaz or teacher, is very much important. If our dear listeners are really interested in the concept self-building, I introduced the book Self-Building, written by Ayatollah Ibrahim Amini, the late Ayatollah Ibrahim Amini, we missed him recently, past 1 year, translated by Sayyid Hussein Alamdar. This is a really nice book, gives you practical guidelines how to build yourself and recognize yourself as a path through Allah's recognition. It was very kind of you, Brother Ali Alavian, and Said Mohsen Naqvi, thank you very much. And dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Viewpoints and Analysis on the Speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Visit our website, parstoday.com/Iran Call of Islam page, also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. May Allah bless you all. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, there you are, guiding me through. Whenever I feel down, you can lift me up, turning my life around with your love. No matter how rough it gets, I can wear a smile, 'cause your mercy never dries, yeah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. How orderly are these galaxy and the world in which we live? All the discoveries that were made during the history by astronomers and astrologists have been based on the order of the celestial bodies and planets. If it was not so, then they could not find such an order and symmetry in their calculations. Now, the interesting point is that if there is a mistake or problem in calculations, it is with the sciences and their interpretations and not the systematic and orderly manner of the creation by Allah. In other words, solar system is working based on the order that was destined for it by Allah.
الان این چیزهایی که میفرستن به کرات دیگه تمام اینا بر اساس همون
This point is completely witnessed in the discoveries of spaceships to the other planets too. The spaceships are able to reach their destinations only if they are in harmony with order of the solar system and the other planets. In fact, there is a specific calculation in their works, but their calculations adjust the higher calculations that were made by Allah in the whole solar system. These are all the signs of the wisdom of Allah in His creation of the galaxy. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khalaf Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Khalaf Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
The U.S. society is dominated by the rich, who have the ultimate say on public policy and elections. If one wants to understand how policy is determined in the U.S., one will need to look at the opinions of the wealthy and how they invest their money. The U.S. political system features in authentic political parties that lack organized public participation, and where elite-run candidate selection institutions reflect the opinions and interests of the rich. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Raiko Kalandai's writer. This article is published under the heading, Biden's victory was hardly a win for democracy. It was another win for the 1%. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Of a newly elected Biden administration, many have proclaimed that a triumph of democracy has taken place. But was Joe Biden's win really a victory for democracy? The evidence suggests otherwise, by a wide margin. The 2020 election was the most expensive election on record, with Democrats outspending Republicans in both congressional and federal contests. Spending was just shy of $14 billion in total, an unprecedented record and double the amount of 2016. In fact, the Biden campaign broke monthly and online campaign funding contributions of all time, boosted in large part by Wall Street donors. Biden's campaign, in fact, became the first ever to raise over $1 billion in campaign donations. Donald Trump, on the other hand, finished second in total campaign contributions by a presidential candidate, beating out Obama's 2008 record-shattering numbers. In fact, this characterizes the overall trends. The Financial Times writes that listed companies increased their donations to Democratic Group this year over the Republicans, noting that this was a sign that executives are trying to win favor with liberals on expectations of conservative defeats nationwide in the November elections. Furthermore, both presidential campaigns were boosted by unprecedented outside spending by big money super PACs and dark money groups that were bolstered by ultra-wealthy individuals. In fact, the greater the contributions, the less transparent the Biden campaign became with records, even going as far as declining to disclose the names of its most prominent fundraisers. If we take an even closer look, the picture becomes even bleaker, revealing how undemocratic the United States of America really is. Political scientist Thomas Ferguson, an authoritative scholar on money and electoral politics, has a valuable and established political science theory called the investment theory of politics. It demonstrates that the United States of America is essentially controlled by coalitions of investors who come together around some mutual interest. Thus, to participate in the political arena, you must have enough resources and private power to become part of such a coalition. He argues that since the early 19th century, there has been a persistent struggle for power among these groups of investors. Moments of conflict come along when groups of investors have differing points of view on public policy, while on policies where large investors are in agreement, no party struggle takes part. Importantly, parties attempt to change the public's opinion to match those of its investors. These findings are applicable elsewhere. In fact, further research by Ferguson and his colleagues on the effect of wealthy investors and money on election outcomes has shown that campaign expenditures are an excellent predictor of U.S. congressional races. Money in American politics suggests that analysis of the American political system should begin by looking closely at money politics when they attempt to understand political change, especially political systems' steady shift to the right since the late 1960s. Our tentative conclusion is that Singh should, after all, be believing. The case in favor of the proportion that money drives U.S. elections is significantly strengthened. Ferguson's research on the political power of the rich is no outlier either. A major study by Princeton scholar Martin Gillens and Northwestern University professor Benjamin Page reveals that the vast majority of the population, about 70% on the lower end of the wealth and income scale, is essentially excluded from policy decisions and effectively unrepresented. They conclude that as you move up the scale, influence gradually increases. More importantly, when you reach the very top of the scale, these affluent groups essentially determine policy. The authors reveal that regardless of a Republican or Democratic head of government, the government follows the policy preferences of major lobbying or business groups rather than policy preferences of the general population. They determine that if policy making is dominated by powerful business organizations and a small number of affluent Americans, then America's claims to being a democratic society are seriously threatened. Yet, even with these stark conclusions, the study had its limitations. One is that it didn't show who among the rich and wealthy has the greatest influence. Additionally, it excluded major business groups such as the Business Council and the Committee for Economic Development and neglected to note the importance of individual firms and investors. The latest research published this year by two analysts, Sean Maguire and Charles DeHunt, fills these gaps and builds upon this work, reinforcing the observations even further. Utilizing artificial intelligence and machine learning, Maguire and DeHunt advance the thesis by showing it is actually worse than what others have found. Their study reveals and confirms that the top wealthiest 10% ultimately always win on policy, effectively showing that anyone else's opinion outside of top 10% rarely matters. Thus, the preferences of the top 10%, along with the opinions of certain interest groups, can effectively explain and determine how policy is hammered out with remarkable accuracy. As such, the opinions of those in the lower scale of income reduces the accuracy of prediction in accordance with Gillens and Page's similar findings. Maguire and DeHunt's objective was to examine to what degree legislative outcomes could be predicted based on the preferences of the rich, and to a lesser extent, business interest groups by applying a machine learning tool to Gillens and Page's data set on 1,836 major U.S. federal government policies, policy opinions of the top 10 richest in income percentile, and interest group preferences to build a predictive model of U.S. policy. Their conclusion was strong. Policy outcomes were predictable with a 70% degree accuracy utilizing the policy preferences of those in 90th income percentile, showing the rich speak with their wallets. In fact, they even note that while 90th income percentile functions as a proxy for the opinions of elites, the results would probably fare even better if they had data on the opinions of the top 1%. They conclude what is generally suspected. The likely Lotus Star variable affecting policy outcomes is the transfer of large amounts of money to policymakers from the wealthiest sources focused intensely on particular policies. Every new study that concerns the power of the rich on U.S. democracy is more striking than the last. Biden's election victory only adds more evidence to these overall trends. In fact, as we have seen, this isn't at all surprising. U.S. society is dominated by the rich, who have the ultimate say on public policy and elections. If one wants to understand how policy is determined in the United States of America, one will need to look at the opinions of the wealthy and how they invest their money. The U.S. political system features inauthentic political parties that lack organized public participation, and where elite-run candidate selection institutions reflect the opinions and interests of the rich. As a result, the feelings of discontent are clear through the gradual rise of conspiracy theories, the rise of con artist politicians like Donald Trump, and the rise of religious fundamentalism and other social ills. Yet it is important to note that 82% of Americans not unrealistically hold the opinion that the rich have too much influence in politics. A majority of the population favor a wealth tax on the rich. Thus, recent proclamations of a restoration of democracy are nothing more than fallacy, contrary to recent mainstream pronouncements. In light of all this, McGuire and DeHaan comment that it is strange to observe the fight for democracy currently playing out on screens across the U.S., yet the underlying disease, money-driven policy outcomes leading to present-day symptoms, goes mostly unspoken. Additionally, the current election is of critical importance, but a society that pins its hopes for democracy on quadrennial extravaganzas heavily funded by wealthy interests will be disappointed, as these players will perpetually win the game. It is very important to note that this doesn't mean that all is lost. In order for the general population to have a say in their affairs, they would need, as Page and Gillen's advocate, a social movement for democracy to counter the extraordinary power of the wealthiest of the society of the U.S. This movement, they note, should be similar to the Civil Rights and New Deal era movements. To this end, if the Biden administration were to cancel a student and medical debt or pass extremely popular policies like Medicare for All, an authentic and organized mass movement is the only way to make progressive policies possible.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن.
Allah
هو ذا المنان.
لا إله إلا الله.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to another episode from series of Q&A on Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. If you have been following this series of sessions and shows, we have been talking about different questions and misconceptions concerning some Islamic issues, and the respected guest speakers and guests of this show will try to provide us with some answers. Today, again, like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, researcher from Qom Seminary Schools, to answer the questions that we pose in this verse session. Shaykhana, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. And today we shall be talking, and we shall start with a question concerning the issue of hijab. Tell us, why don't men need to wear hijab first, and then inshallah we shall talk about the standards of the modest dress and hijab between men and women on the second hand. But the first point that we want to focus and talk about is the hijab and covering for the men, and what is the reason that it is only necessary for the women to be covered. I'd be glad if you shed some light on this question.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Comparing men and women, when we are talking about the spiritual aspects, we know that according to Islam, there is no difference between men and women. When it comes to creation, according to Islam, they were created from the same soil, Adam and Eve. When it comes to the rights, when it comes to moral and ethical issues, when it comes to freedom of speech, thinking, and so on and so forth, there is no difference between men and women. Mm-hmm. But it is also proved in today's science that when it comes to bodily structure, there are differences between men and women, and no one can shed any doubt about this. Even the feminists cannot claim that there is no difference between men and women when it comes to their body and body parts and body structure.
True.
So it is well proved in science that regarding the structure of the body of men and women, there are many differences. In the brain, the structure of the brain, heart, vein, nerves, and so on and so forth. So when we put together all these elements, physical elements, we can claim that regarding emotions, the women are more stronger than men, and I think all the people agree about this fact. And also when it comes to beauty, I think again all people agree that women are the symbols of beauty. Inshallah, we'll come back to this point. But regarding the hijab or veil of men, first of all, we should not think that the injunction of hijab or veil is only for women in Islam. Hijab is for both men and women, but the method and the way is different.
So what is the hijab for men then?
According to Islamic jurisprudence, of course, people should refer to their religious authorities, but men should, when it comes to non-mahram women, men need to cover the parts which they normally cover. They cannot go, even if they cover their private parts, they cannot show up in the streets before the non-mahram women. The only difference is about the covering the hair. Otherwise, women cannot go out naked, even if they, cover their body parts. So we should not think that according to Islam, hijab is only for women and it does not include men.
Very true.
And we have some narrations in this regard. For example, even, there are slight differences among the scholars. For example, when it comes to wearing T-shirts, for example, when it is allowed for men and women, we are not going to talk about the jurisprudence. But all in all, men also need to cover their body. They cannot go out, without wearing shirt. Even they are not allowed, according to most of the scholars, to go out with shorts. They need to cover the feet as well. Again, there are narrations which prohibit men from wearing tight clothes. Mm-hmm. In one narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that it does not behoove for a man to remove his clothes so that his thighs are clear for other people. So the feet of men should not be revealed for non-mahram people. So the first answer is that the injunction and the verdict of hijab also includes men. But there are differences when it comes to the extent of this covering. Now, people might ask that your second question was also the standards of modesty. So modesty is something common for both men and women. The standards are the same. But when we want to apply those standards, Islam says that women should cover themselves more than men, like covering the hair.
Yeah.
And it has at least two reasons why Islam does not oblige men also to cover their heads and the hair and those body parts which the women are asked by Islam to cover. The first point is that, as I mentioned, according to Islam, and I think all the schools of thought agree that woman is the symbol of beauty and man is the symbol of looking for beauty. I mean, women are more interested in, exposing themselves. And men are more interested in looking at women, if we may put it this way. Let me give you an example. You know that according to Islam, men are not obliged to cover themselves as the women do. But forget about Islam and any other religion. Today also we see that when men, even in Western countries, they go outside the house, they cover themselves more than women. It means that even if there is no obligation upon the men, and men are themselves, they are interested in wearing themselves. They are not interested in exposing themselves, in uncovering their body parts. You see what I mean? Even in the society, you do not see that. You see that. But on the other hand, women are more interested in exposing themselves. So it tells us that this is a principle. Men are more interested in watching and seeing. We are talking about...
So if they are more interested in watching and looking for the beauty, then they make themselves more beautiful than the women, with regard to the dressing itself. But we see that ladies are covering themselves less than what men do, actually.
Yeah, this is my point. I mean, my point is that forget about Islam. In Western countries, you see that women, they cover themselves less than men. It shows us this principle that woman is the symbol of beauty, and women are interested in showing themselves and their bodies. Men are not interested in that. Men want to see, women want and like to be seen. And this is the difference between men and women. And that is why the obligation of hijab is for women and not for men. Because to begin with...
The obligation is more for women. I think it's better to be said like this.
Since women are more interested to show themselves, and even in the houses, you see that in most of the cases, women are less covered than the men. Women like to show themselves. And this is, an interesting desire. We are not objecting that when it comes to the house and wife and husband. So my point is that even if you forget about any religion, the desire of the men is to see women.
And the ladies to be seen.
To be seen. And that is why we have the obligation of hijab for women. Now we come to the second point, which completes the first one. And that is the fact that even according to today's science, men are more provoked by seeing. When we compare men and women, I'm sorry to mention this example, but let's assume that we have a lady half naked and a man half naked. Usually men are provoked, sexually speaking, are more provoked than, by seeing a half naked woman than a woman seeing a half naked man. And this is well proved. Yeah. We are not negating that, women are also provoked. Mm-hmm. It is true. But we are just comparing the amount of provocation when it comes to men and women.
It has been said that in response to this simple sample that you have presented, Sheikh, it is being said that in case in Islamic communities, people get used to wearing like this, they will. It becomes like a habit, and this provocation will not happen anymore. Is it true? Because they say this sort of, let's say, provoking that you are talking about is because the society has got some limitations on these issues, and people cannot since they have already been limited and forced to be limited. Then this becomes a new phenomenon for themselves, for them. So in case this becomes prevalent in the whole society, this provocation will not happen.
Thanks for this very valid question. I think maybe 50 or years ago or one century ago, it was very difficult to answer this question. But nowadays, because of the fact that in the West, in many Western communities, unfortunately, this is happening. Men and women, they have no limitation when it comes to covering themselves. But in practice, so the claim is that when men are used to see the half-naked women, there is no provocation anymore. But in practice, we see that in those countries, in those communities where hijab is not practiced, again, the rate of rape and other sexual-related crimes are more. Mm-hmm. So, if we can, if the claim is that men are less provoked when they used to see these scenes every day, so what is the reason that the rate of such crimes are more in such?
So you want to say that the habit cannot.
Be changed. It could be reduced, but again, it is. Some people claim that. Not only it's not reduced, it is increased as well. But in practice, what we see in those communities where hijab is not practiced, we see that the statistics tell us that this is not the case. Men have these intrinsic desire to see women, whether they see these scenes every day or they are prohibited from that.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your beautiful explanations and, let's say, comprehensive explanations and the light that you have shed on this point. And inshallah, we shall continue the discussion on some new issues, even new misconceptions concerning the Islamic questions. Till next show, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Dear listeners, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Promoting natural herd immunity, which Trump and others in his administration have consistently done, would undoubtedly lead to more individuals having to live with serious long-term health issues. Since the start of the pandemic, more than 15.2 million Americans have contracted the coronavirus. And as of now, 286,443 individuals have died from COVID-19. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Trump backs herd immunity and calls millions contracting COVID? Terrific! Here's the details of this article. During a White House coronavirus vaccine event that took place on Tuesday, December 8, Donald Trump appeared to voice strong support for the idea of so-called natural herd immunity, the controversial idea that the population can develop immunities and stop the spread of a virus simply by allowing it to run its course without significant efforts to mitigate it. Throughout the year, Trump has been reluctant to back social distancing standards, including encouraging individuals to restrict personal travel and to wear masks, which have been found effective in actually limiting the spread of COVID-19. He has also dangerously downplayed the seriousness of coronavirus in spite of describing the pandemic as deadly earlier this year in an interview with Bob Woodward. On Tuesday, December 8, Trump described vaccines for COVID-19 as goal that was number one because that's the way it ends, referring to the pandemic. But in other comments, he suggested that large numbers of infections in the U.S. over the past year were somehow a good thing. I hear we're close to 15%. I'm hearing that, and that's terrific. That's a very powerful vaccine in itself, Trump said, describing the number of Americans estimated to have had coronavirus so far. In fact, a recent study from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, notes that closer to 16% of Americans have likely had the virus, many without presenting symptoms. But that means a significant number haven't yet been exposed to COVID-19. This indicates that approximately 84% of the U.S. population has not yet been infected, and thus most of the country remains at risk despite already high rates of hospitalization, a report from the health agency said. Over the past several months, White House officials have demonstrated an eagerness to accept the idea of herd immunity, even going so far as to peddle a petition that signaled support for the concept from supposed medical professionals. While the petition did include real doctors and health professionals who believed in promoting the herd immunity, many of the names on the list turned out to be pranks